sure you're all familiar with Nick. He's a long-time activist in Wollongong, works at the University of Wollongong there, and you'll know him from all sorts of troublemaking projects. The way we're going to run this today, Nick and I will have a discussion for about half an hour, and then there'll be plenty of time for your comments and questions. If anything occurs to you in the first half an hour, just hold on to it, and we will get to it in good time. All right, without further ado, let's get things underway. Nick, I feel like a good place to start would be with some definitions. I'm sure people here are familiar with the notion of disaster capitalism, which, of course, was a term popularized by Naomi Klein, which is the title of an Anthony Lowenstein book. Your book is entitled Disaster Communism. What is disaster communism?
Yep, okay. So, really, disaster communism is my response, in a way, to Naomi Klein's coining of the term disaster capitalism. And I read The Shock Doctrine when it came out in 2007, 2008, around that time, and was really struck by how important that analysis was given what had happened in Iraq, but also given the fact that we were seeing the intensification of climate change disasters and a range of disasters. And I think that book really exposed and researched very well how significant sections of capital and its state forms were going to make a buck out of this. They were going to take advantage of it. That they actually thought this was a business opportunity, a growing business opportunity, and the dangers and the destructiveness of that approach. And then I read, in the years after, a couple of years after, I read Rebecca Solnit's book, A Paradise Built in Hell, which is about the sort of grassroots responses to disasters and looks back over a number of those. And then in 2011, when the Queensland floods hit, I was sort of awestruck by the power of that disaster, and it was close by and impacting family and friends and so forth. And so I started to think about what is the opposite to disaster capitalism? Can we actually see that occurring in the response of ordinary people to that disaster in Brisbane, in Queensland? And so I started to explore how people were responding in the best ways and coined the term disaster communism, when I was writing about those responses, to talk about the communistic responses of ordinary people to disasters as both an immediate response to the disasters, but then also a defence against disaster capitalism and the development of alternative forms of organising that I would think we can consider communistic. I can go more into the definition.
Okay, let's tease that out a little bit, because it's always been part of the ideological foundations of the ruling class, isn't it? To say that if ever they stopped ruling us, then we would immediately lapse into a kind of Lord of the Flies situation. We'd be eating each other in about five minutes. You say instead that disaster prizes open the limits of the possible. So do you want to talk about how that manifested in the Brisbane flood specifically?
Yeah, so I think what tends to happen in disasters is the normal structures of society are weakened, some of them are demolished, they sort of tend to fall apart, and that, while that creates, can potentially create a whole range of disasters, it can also open up spaces of greater freedom for people to then have the time and the ability to organise alternatives to the dominant ways that the dominant forms that structure their lives. And so both capital and its state forms in some senses weakened, and rather than the disaster movie, you know, sort of tropes that we see of people, you know, retreating and defending their turf and trampling over other people to, you know, get what they need and or escape the disaster. And what, we don't see that, right? The common, the general reaction of most people is, in fact, to try and help each other. They rescue each other. They look after each other. They care for each other. They share resources. They organise to collectively respond in constructive ways that are usually more efficient than the state responses, even if, you know, and often there are no state responses, and so, you know, obviously they're better than nothing. People are rescued and people are cared for and resources are shared, wealth is redistributed. There's a whole range of sort of communistic things that occur when that those disasters hit, which makes a lie out of the ideology of capitalism and neoliberalism that we're all self-absorbed, self-interested, we don't care about other people, and all that Hobbesian view of, you know, human nature, that we're all basically going to turn on each other if the state, you know, isn't there to stop us doing that.
Okay, so to pry into this a little bit, what would you say is a underlying basis of this phenomenon that you're describing? People start cooperating when there is a crisis or a disaster. Is this a sort of moral impulse? Is it just a sort of does it just emerge from the basic decency of people? Is there a material underpinning to it? And if so, what might that be? So where does it come from, this impetus to look after each other?
Yeah, look, I think there is a moral, material basis to it, but I think importantly, these things are the sort of disaster communism, and I think I say in one of the pieces, is everyday communism writ large. So these practices emerge from already existing social relationships and ways of organising that people use in their everyday lives to deal with the everyday disasters of living in a capitalist society and you know, years of struggle in both formal and informal ways that people have experience in, they've learned lessons from, and they sort of put those into action. Often, you know, it's neighbourhood connections, community connections, forms of organisation that exist prior to the disasters, and they, again, may be formal forms of organising or informal forms of organising that are then put into action or expanded, or new forms are created out of those for the circumstances that have changed because of the disasters. So, yeah, I mean, there's people have learnt there's materially good reason to look after each other, you know, that if you create sort of mutual aid relationships, if you reciprocate care, then the people involved are all advantaged, right? That's how we get through the difficulties of life. People understand that in many ways. And people in general do care about other people. They are interested in, you know, friends, neighbours, but also in the welfare of strangers. So, you know, I was struck, I write about the Twin Towers, and I was struck at the time about how a lot of the people working in those Twin Towers were sort of supposed to be the personifications of the, you know, sort of greed is good, yuppie. And how many of them, you know, a lot of people died in those towers basically because they were trying to help other people. Mm. That there was, you know, and the way they went down the steps without anybody trampling anybody, everybody just looked after each other because they understood that that was the best way for all of them to respond to this disaster without making it even more disastrous.
So in the book, you go through a variety of different disasters, from the Brisbane floods to the bushfires in 2019 to 9/11 to COVID. Is there a particular example that maybe you give people that sort of embodies this phenomenon that you call disaster communism in a particularly clear way?
I write about it in different ways, using different disasters. So I don't know that there's one that particularly embodies it in that sense. I think it's, you know, my view of communism is that it's a whole range of different practices, and therefore there isn't sort of a this is it, right? It's incredibly diverse. There's a whole range of ways you struggle to make the world better. I don't have a sort of blueprint and point to a certain practice. So I try to cover a whole range of things that people do in the struggle to make, you know, to take control of their own lives, to create more democratic forms of organising, to challenge and resist capital and the you know, the different way the state operates and so forth. And that includes struggling within and against the state and autonomous from the state. And so, yeah, I don't think there's a number of stories I like, particularly in, you know, I've been asked a number of times about the Ruby Princess one during the pandemic. Some people like that one because I think often there's this sense that, oh yeah, we sort of look after our neighbours and, you know, we might care about people who are close by or similar to us and so forth. And that's the sort of restriction of it. It doesn't get any further than that. And when the Ruby Princess docked in Wollongong during the pandemic, and people may remember there was a big uproar when it docked in Sydney, and it, you know, there was a lot of people who were sick. It was early on in the pandemic. A lot of people went on to die, and they let the passengers off. So they let the passengers off in Sydney, and there was, I think, there was a coronial inquiry, there was a special police inquiry, there was another sort of court case about it. There's a whole range of things and lots of individual court cases about it because they let the passengers off. And then they basically, the authorities said, right, well, let's send the ship somewhere because the crew are still on board and there's a big crew and they're sick. Not all of them, but a lot of them as well, and they didn't know what to do. So they sent them down to Port Kembla, and I'm from Wollongong, and so we're like, oh, okay, they're sending them down here. That's an interesting choice. I wonder why they're doing that, apart from getting them out of Sydney, which I think probably they, because of the uproar, they wanted to get them out of Sydney. So they sent them down to Port Kembla, and as there was some people in Wollongong and some people who should have known better who were like, oh, stop the boats, you know, like, don't let them in, or they're infected and so forth, you know, we've already let the passengers off, don't let the crew, you know, get off as well. But mainly the response from the local community was much more positive. But there was a significant obstacle because the government greeted the ship with the police and the military, and they refused to provide them with public health care that was available and sent in Aspen Medical, which is a sort of, well, it's connected, closely connected to the Australian military. And so they wanted to control the way the health care was provided, but also control the information, because there was already this uproar about what they'd done and the negligence and the people who were dying and so forth. And so the crew was stuck on the ship. The military were now controlling the dock with the police, and they were patrolling the area and trying to keep people away. And the local trade union movement and the local community went, well, we want to do something to care for the workers on this ship. That's our responsibility. That's our history. We have a very proud history in Wollongong of doing that, and we want to do it. And so they got in touch with the people on the ship. The local community started putting pressure, first of all exposing the role of that Aspen Medical and what they were doing, and calling for them to get proper medical attention, to get tested, proper testing, to be able to get access to the hospital and so forth if they needed it, and if they needed to get home, because a lot of them were from the Philippines and places like that, for them to have the ability to be repatriated in, you know, given the circumstances. And so there was this community outpouring of concern, and then pressure being put on the authorities, and at the same time, various groups sent created care packages. So there was a few thousand care packages created that then were got onto the ship, and eventually, well, it didn't take that long, but over time, all of the demands were won. So all of the crew were properly tested. All of the ones who needed healthcare could get proper healthcare and not just this dodgy company. And all of the crew that wanted to get off the ship could get off the ship and get repatriated. And those who wanted to stay could stay. And then before they left and went off with the people who were not sick and didn't need care and didn't need to go away, the crew then reciprocated by setting up a GoFundMe page and donated all this money to local homeless NGOs, so that homeless people in the Illawarra who were, you know, homeless during the pandemic would have somewhere to live during the pandemic. And when they took the ship out of the harbour, the tugs came out and did the sort of water fountains into the air as a celebration. People lined the harbour, and they had a big banner the crew had put on the back of the ship saying, "Thank you, Illawarra." Mm. And to me, that was a beautiful example of a communistic practice that was widespread incredibly difficult times, when there was a serious disaster happening, when people were having real trouble dealing with their own lives and what was going on in their own lives, and when the authorities were being disastrous on top of the disaster that was already occurring. Mm.